Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in British Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Alan Allport, author of the book Britain at Bay, The Epic Story of the Second World War, 1938 to 1941. Alan, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. Okay. I am a professor of history at Syracuse University in central New York State. As you can probably guess from my voice, I'm not a native Syracusan. I was born in Liverpool in England, and I moved to the United States about 25 years ago and did my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, and then came to Syracuse about 10 years ago. My research specialty is the history of Britain, particularly in the Second World War. And I've written so far three books on that subject. My first book, Demobbed, which came out in 2009, was a history of the demobilization experience of the British Armed Forces at the end of the Second World War. My second book, Browned Off and Bloody Minded, which was published in 2015, was a social history of the British Army during the Second World War. And my new book, Britain at Bay, is the first volume in a two-volume history of Britain in a more general sense during the Second World War.
What led you to go from a focus on the British soldier to writing a more general history of the British experience in the Second World War?
That's a good question. I think, you know, what's tended to happen with all my books is that the further I've gone along, the broader I've gotten. You know, some people go in the opposite direction and get more and more specific in their research, and I have tended to go broader. I think it's because with each passing book, bigger questions seem to have emerged, which I thought deserved some exploration. So with Demobbed, I wrote very specifically about demobilization, which raised questions for me about, well, what was the experience of actually being in the armed forces like during the Second World War, which led me to my second book. And then my second book, of course, raised bigger questions about what society itself, British society, was like during the war. Why were some of the reasons why Britain ended up in the country that it was by 1945? How had the war shaped it? And I felt that there is clearly a very large existing literature on this subject, but some of the answers that were in that literature didn't always strike me as entirely satisfactory. Plus, an awful lot of the literature is also scholarly and extremely important, but not always very accessible to a more general reader. And so one of the aims that I had for this history, of which I've now finished the first volume, is to try and present a lot of the really exciting research that's been done on Britain in the Second World War, but in a more accessible way for an audience which wouldn't necessarily pick up an academic journal or read an academic monograph.
I was thinking as I was reading it is that your approach is revisionist in a sense, and that's a word that I think has become far more loaded than it necessarily has to be. But you definitely are pushing back against some of the received interpretations or received understandings that we have about the war. And you start that not with the war itself, but with the misconceptions that many people might still have about Great Britain in the 1930s. And I was wondering if you could perhaps start us off with the book by talking a bit about perhaps what it is that you're seeking to have us understand about Britain in the 1930s, and in particular the framing device that you use you throughout the book, where you frame it in terms of Tolkien Shire people, which I thought was a very interesting framing device, and about how you feel that this captures a particular mindset that helps us to better understand the British attitude towards Europe, the prospect of war, and then their approach towards the war itself.
Okay. I mean, the reason that I latched onto the idea of looking at the war through Tolkien, I mean, Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings after the Second World War, but its influence on his work is undeniable. And it struck me reading so much of the received wisdom about Britain's wartime role and what Britain was like, that so much of it was filtered through this kind of Tolkien-esque conception of what the British were like in the early part of the 20th century. So I use the expression the Shire folk to talk about this myth. The way in which the British very much conceive themselves and are conceived by others as having been this rather gentle, parochial, innocent people who found themselves dragged into a foreign war, which to begin with they didn't really understand and weren't particularly prepared for. And of course, the problem with this is that it's very hard to square in many ways with the idea of Britain being a global superpower in the years before the Second World War. Britain was in many ways the largest military power on Earth. It controlled 2/5 of the world's land surface. And the sort of the dissonance between those ideas is what got me interested. So, I mean, thinking about Britain in the 1930s, before the war breaks out, many of the myths around the war, and particularly Britain's preparation for the war, come from that period. It's largely taken for granted, for instance, that the British, because of a lack of interest or a lack of desire in taking seriously Hitler's Germany or the threat from fascism, neglected rearmament and found itself in 1939 wholly unprepared for war. This is a complete misunderstanding of what actually happened. I mean, first of all, Britain was always an important military power throughout the wars, between the wars, had by far the largest navy, had a very significant air force for much of the time, and of course with the Indian Army as well as its own army, had a very large army. But throughout certainly the second half of the 1930s, Britain rearms prodigiously under the leadership, of course, of Neville Chamberlain, the much despised Prime Minister who was responsible for the appeasement policy. Chamberlain certainly wishes to try and negotiate a lasting settlement with Hitler. Chamberlain has no desire to go to war for a number of different reasons. But he's also not ignorant of the fact that appeasement will be a most effective policy when it is backed up with realistic deterrence. And so there is an enormous investment in the armed forces, so much so, in fact, that Britain finds itself in some significant financial difficulty by the late 30s because of the cost of this, the buildup of this military industrial complex. Now, much of the payoff for that rearmament effort doesn't actually manifest itself until several years into the war, and Britain and France suffer some very significant military defeats in 1940, obviously the fall of France being the most important of these. But that's not because of lack of preparation per se. One could argue that the British and French didn't prepare in exactly the right way, or that they didn't use exactly the right operational plan in order to try and confront the Germans. But it's not for a lack of willingness to spend on armaments. So this is just one example of the way in which, you know, the received understanding about in popular culture about what, you know, Britain was like and the reality differ quite a bit.
I should have, that was one of the things that I really appreciated about your use of the Shire Folk as a framing device, is that you were very careful not to push it too far. I mean, how you set that image, for example, against what was happening, say, in Palestine, where the military was, you know, participating in what we, you know, would regard as an anti-insurgency campaign, or how you talked about how they were hardly a peaceful Shire Folk because they were dealing with an IRA bombing campaign. And how, when you talk about these, it's a slightly different picture of who the British were in the 1930s that makes it in some ways understandable why it was that people were not necessarily as appalled by what was happening in Germany, or why they were not as, you know, why they were thinking that they had, you know, concerns of their own and did not want to be engaged.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to try and demolish was the idea of the British being particularly peaceful. I mean, it could be argued, and I will going to explore this more in the second volume, that, you know, one of the reasons why the British win the Second World War ultimately is because they're quite prepared to not be at all nice. The second part of the war in particular is mostly about the British killing other people. It is not the British themselves being killed. And they turn out to be very effective at this. They're very good at killing on an industrial scale, most obviously manifested in the strategic bombing campaign. But even you know, before this, we see Britain as being an often ruthless imperial power in the late 1930s. That's how you become an imperial power. You don't become it by being soft-hearted. I also wanted to explore in those early chapters the way in which, if we look at the United Kingdom more broadly, it is in many ways not a very peaceable kingdom. The last few years have shown the way in which many Britons remain ignorant of the fact that the United Kingdom is not just England, Scotland, and Wales, but also Northern Ireland. It's very hard to look at the story of Northern Ireland in the 1930s and think of this as being a peaceable kingdom. In fact, there are some uncomfortable parallels at times between the kind of sectarian violence that's going on in Ulster and the kind of events that are taking place on the continent. So this was something I wanted to get at. The other thing about the 30s is that, you know, we tend to think of Britain before the war in two very polarized ways. One is of the sort of Downton Abbey view of Britain as being a land of aristocrats and country houses. And the other is of a Britain of misery, poverty, unemployment, the kind of scenes of squalor and depression that you think of in something like George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier. Now, both of these things existed, of course, but there was also a different kind of Britain that was emerging in the 1930s, and one that was to prove to be crucial to its success in the Second World War. This is a very modern Britain that's partly a legacy of the First World War, a Britain which is concerned with modern engineering, with modern science and technology. You look at the kind of places like in the West Midlands or in some of the outer towns around Greater London, in which the modern automobile industry was developing, the modern aviation industry, radio, and, you know, this is a Britain which is not looking into the past, but in many ways is a very forward-looking place. And it's a view which has sort of disappeared because after 1945, the 1930s became vilified in many ways as being this sort of lost decade of, you know, of the dole, mass unemployment and poverty, to which the, you know, the post-1945 world was compared very unfavorably. But that's not really the case. There was a lot of misremembering about what Britain had been like. Britain, in many ways, has a quite dynamic economy in the 1930s, for instance. This is not a land of pure depression. And these things matter when it comes to the preparation and eventually the fighting of the Second World War.
You also address the source of a lot of those misconceptions. And here I'm thinking about how you, when you're talking about the 1930s and appeasement and rearmament, you address, among other things, the role of Winston Churchill, who has this has an image that's very difficult to shake, in part because he was, as the saying might go, he was present at the creation of it, because he sat down and wrote his memoirs and conveyed a certain narrative that has played into a lot of what you just described and then reinforced it. And this gets to how we see Churchill as someone who is standing up from the start against the Nazis, and how he's pushing back against Chamberlain's refusal to rearm. And as you explained, just in the same way as Britain was rearming in the 1930s under Chamberlain's direction, so too Winston Churchill was not quite the absolute, irresolute, all-time opponent of everything related to appeasement that he subsequently encouraged us to think.
Right. Well, the story of appeasement this is perhaps the classic case in the 20th century of a story in which the popular memory distorts so much of what actually took place. Churchill had the inestimable advantage over Chamberlain in two ways. First of all, he was still alive when the war ended, and Chamberlain had died in 1940, and so wasn't around to defend his actions. The other was that Churchill was a marvelous writer. I don't think anybody could ever deny that. And his 6-volume history of the Second World War in many ways established a lot of the popular myths of the war. Churchill, needless to say, wanted to represent his own story in as sympathetic a way as possible. And while his history of the war remains an invaluable source, and it's a wonderful read too, it also includes an awful lot of misconception. I mean, one of the things that Churchill wanted to do after 1945, of course, was to present his own attitudes in the 1930s as having been entirely consistent, which they were not. He ebbed and flowed. He didn't always have a completely consistent view about the fascist dictators, for instance. He was always far more hostile towards Hitler than he had been towards Mussolini, for instance, with whom he had a much more ambivalent view. The other issue is that the arguments over foreign policy in the 1930s are often presented in a very binary way, as if there was one single coherent group of people called appeasers, led by Neville Chamberlain, and an equally coherent group of anti-appeasers led by Churchill. And that's problematic for a few reasons. One is that many people who were opposed to Chamberlain's policy didn't particularly support Churchill, who had baggage of his own. He was a Tory. He had been someone whose reputation had been very badly damaged by the arguments over Indian politics in the early 1930s. He was also old too, and was in many ways was seen as being a rather outdated figure. Other anti-appeasers, such as Anthony Eden, who would be Churchill's deputy during the war, were actually much more significant figures in the 1930s than we tend to remember now. The other issue is that the anti-appeasers were often a lot clearer about what they didn't like than what they did like. Chamberlain often got very frustrated about this, in that he felt that whether you liked his policy or not towards Hitler, he felt that it was at least a coherent policy that you could actually understand. And he often objected to his critics by saying, well, what else do you think we should do? Do you think that, for instance, in 1937, should we actually go to war with Adolf Hitler? And, if we did go to war with him, would we actually win the war? Would we have a realistic chance of defeating him? Would we be able to bring the country and the empire along with us? Do we have a legitimate and clear-cut enough, cause for war in order to unify the country? And if we don't have these things, and I think Chamberlain would have said that, in 1937 and perhaps in 1938 too, these things did not exist, then what else are we supposed to do? And his critics often didn't have a very clear answer for that, which is one of the reasons, of course, for the fact that appeasement was an extremely popular policy. It was the anti-appeasers really don't represent a large, you know, body of public opinion until fairly late, really, in 1939. So this is just one way in which I think, you know, poor Chamberlain, who is not, it has to be said, a very commendable figure in terms of personality. One of the things I make a point of saying in Britain at Bay is that the more that you learn about Chamberlain personally, the easier he is to personally dislike. He's an extremely arrogant man, prickly, vain, bigoted, unimaginative in lots of ways. He's not an attractive figure on a personal level, and he's certainly much less attractive than Churchill in terms of his writing. Yeah, that doesn't necessarily mean he was wrong all the time. And the more that I read about him in my preparation for the book, the more sympathy I had for him in terms of the dilemma that he found himself in. It was just not a good idea to be British Prime Minister in 1937 and 1938 and 1939. Whoever had taken that role, and that includes Churchill in those years, would have faced many of the same dilemmas as Chamberlain. And the answers would not at all have been easy. It's always easier, of course, to carp from the sidelines, which is what used to frustrate Chamberlain so much. So, I do hope that, you know, the book, and this is the impression that I've got from some of the reader feedback, is that it has at least persuaded some people to rethink or to give a second thought to some of the dilemmas of appeasement, and to perhaps credit Chamberlain with more. To credit him with having to deal with a tremendously difficult problem in which there were no simple answers and there were lots of choices, all of which were bad choices in their own ways, and to feel as though he was not simply perhaps the naive pantomime dupe that he tends to be presented in popular memory.
Another area where you look twice at something and ask us to reconsider is the phony war period. And this is another period that we hear, that's the phrase that's typically given to the first 10 months of the war, when Britain and France are at war with Germany. There's definitely fighting taking place. There are definitely casualties suffered, but it's not, you know, the sort of active, ongoing struggle between armies that characterized, say, the First World War. What was going on there, and in what ways have we misunderstood or had that period of the history misrepresented?
Well, the phony war is obviously seen in hindsight in light of the fall of France in June of 1940. France falls in a lightning campaign just 6 weeks. This shocks the world. Nobody had anticipated that France would fall so quickly. And of course, in light of that, what the Allies had been trying to do in the 8 to 10 months previous to this obviously did not look so good. And, you know, immediately the vilification started. You know, where did we go wrong? Where were the lost opportunities? Was this a period in which we sort of, you know, rather naively or hubristically sat and did nothing and allowed Hitler the opportunity to prepare and to pounce upon us. If you want history to look well on you, then you need to win. So it's understandable that the strategy of the phony war doesn't look so good in hindsight. However, if we ignore the end of the defeat of France for a moment, which it's arguable is an event which is very contingent and not at all predictable. There is actually a lot to be said for the basic strategy that the British and the French employed at the beginning of the war. It was founded on some fundamental axioms, one of which was that a militaristic dictatorship like Hitler's Germany would always be better prepared psychologically, if not materially, for the beginning of a war. It was going to take time to prepare democratic populations for the kind of sacrifices and the kind of bloodshed that a war would require. In other words, Hitler was always going to have the advantage at the beginning of the war, and it was not going to be possible to defeat Hitler's Germany in a very short war that lasted just a few months. So attempting an immediate attack upon Nazi Germany was not a strategy of success. However, both Chamberlain and Edouard Daladier and Paul Reynaud, who replaced him then as French Prime Minister, you know, they all believe that in the long run, the Allies have the advantage. If the war goes on for 2 or 3 years, then the sheer material advantages that the Allies possess, not just their own domestic economies and their extensive global empires, but also the access they have to the resources of the New World, particularly the United States, means that inevitably they will win a war like that. So, you know, good strategy is supposed to be about avoiding your own vulnerabilities and emphasizing your own strengths. So it seemed to make a great deal of sense to actually sit back, allow the Germans, if they so wished, to attempt a knockout blow against the Allies, hopefully absorb that blow and successfully defend against it, and then prepare their own strength for a counteroffensive after 2 or 3 years. Now, it doesn't work. The strategy does not work. That is clear. At least it doesn't work for France. Britain manages to get away with it, but it doesn't work for the French. Does that mean that it was necessarily a terrible strategy? I would argue no. In fact, in many ways, it's still basically the strategy that the Allies used to defeat Nazi Germany by 1945, by slowly building up material strength and eventually invading Europe and defeating the Germans by sheer weight of numbers. It's just that its initial application fails. But that's a failure of execution. That's not a failure of the concept itself. In many ways, I think that the German strategy at the beginning of the war was far weaker in principle. The Germans were actually attempting something that was far more implausible. It's just that sometimes there are black swan events in history. Things just work out in an unpredictable, perhaps even implausible ways. And in hindsight then, those who are the victors on the battlefield look like geniuses, and those who are defeated look like fools, even though there might not necessarily have been anything wrong with the basic concept behind the strategy of the losers.
So let's talk a bit about how that switch took place, that black swan event of the fall of France. And of course, it's an event that is preceded by the fall of Chamberlain because of a different event, which was the fall of Norway. What happened there, and what brought about the change to where this politically dominant figure, widely respected, don't want to go quite so far as to say beloved by his party, is replaced by someone who, as you've already demonstrated in the book, was seen by some as a scoundrel, as unreliable. As someone who, it was something of a gamble in himself in terms of whether or not he would provide the sort of leadership they needed at a time in which it seemed the war was turning against the British.
Yeah. So Chamberlain falls in early May of 1940. It's interesting that if you look at the opinion polls, opinion polling was kind of in its infancy at this point, but Gallup was doing some opinion polling about, prime ministerial favorability. Is that right up to the early part of 1940, Chamberlain still is an extremely popular figure within Britain, far more popular than Churchill. And indeed, Gallup even asked the voters, if you had a choice between Churchill and Chamberlain, who would you prefer to be prime minister? And Chamberlain still emerged as by far as the popular choice. I think what happens by the late spring of 1940 is that there is both the doubts are starting to creep in a little bit about this wait and see policy, which I've just described, this kind of sitting back and allowing the Germans to take the initiative to begin with while we slowly accrue our strength. And there is a slight sense of anxiety on the Allied side that, maybe this is a dangerous policy. Maybe there, in fact, that we do need to do something at least to try and kickstart the war. that's the seed of the Norwegian campaign, the decision by the British and French to intervene in Norway. It's a rather complicated story to do with the Soviet attack on Finland, which had taken place late the previous year. But basically, the British and French decide to send an expeditionary force to Norway. Hitler anticipates that they're going to do this and preempts them. And operationally, the Norwegian campaign is a bit of a disaster. And it does, it's something that seems to represent. I mean, Chamberlain is always politically unlucky, in that he often has a habit of saying things which then sort of come back to haunt him. So he had, of course, infamously said right after the Munich Agreement that I believe that, you know, we have peace for our time, which didn't look so prescient a year later. Then shortly before the Norwegian campaign, he famously says, you know, I think Hitler has missed the bus. In other words, you know, Hitler has missed his opportunity to gain victory against the Allies. So with the disaster in Norway a few weeks later, Chamberlain looks rather foolish. And there is a desire to shake up his cabinet amongst many backbench Tory MPs. I don't think, actually, that when the famous Norway debate that takes place in early May, and this is the two-day debate which leads to Chamberlain's resignation, I don't think a lot of his critics actually wanted him to resign. They did want him to change some of the positions in his war cabinet, perhaps to have a more aggressive attitude towards the war. But I think they were genuinely surprised and perhaps even a little dismayed when their rebellion against him meant that he resigned and Churchill took over. Churchill being in many ways a very, in some cases, disliked, or at least somebody was held in the deepest suspicion by many of members of his own party. Not at all a figure in which, you know, large numbers of people had a huge amount of confidence. But anyway, in many ways, the Norwegian campaign might have been a footnote if the battle for France, which takes place immediately afterwards, had been successful. Now, the Germans launched this all-or-nothing attack on France and the Low Countries in May of 1940. Hitler does this not because he is confident, but because he is anxious. He is well aware of the fact that time is really on the Allies' side, not on his. That the longer this war drags out, the more precarious Germany's position will become. In that sense, you know, he wholly agrees with Chamberlain and Daladier about Allied strategy. He thinks that a long war is dangerous for Germany. So he launches this attack. He hopes that his, you know, concentrated use of armored force and surprise will gain him some kind of victory. Most of his generals are extremely pessimistic about this. They think that it's a foolhardy move in lots of ways. They think that it won't work. One of them suggests maybe it's got a 10% chance of succeeding. Well, the thing about 10% chances of succeeding is that 10% of the time they happen. And the Allies make a number of operationally poor decisions, which mean that, unfortunately, they are uniquely exposed to this particular German attack, which comes through the southern Belgian forests, the Ardennes. And even though on paper, in many ways, their position is extremely strong, they manage to make themselves sufficiently vulnerable that the Germans are able to break through their line, and the Allied position collapses like a house of cards. There's no question, of course, that, you know, the Allies make some serious errors. And do those errors represent more fundamental weaknesses in, say, the French army or in Allied planning? There is something to be said for that. The Allies don't go through the phony war without making some mistakes in terms of the exact preparations that they've made. That's undeniable. On the other hand, are they just really, really unlucky in May of June of 1940? I would say to some extent they are. You know, of course, history famously, we can't replay events. We can't go back and have another go and change some of the variables slightly and see what happens. But I have a feeling that if you replayed the Battle of France 10 times, then 9 out of those 10 times, the Germans probably lose, or there is a stalemate in France. The Germans get bogged down somewhere in northern France. Now, if they do get bogged down in that way, then Hitler's prospects are now starting to look increasingly bleak. Most of his best forces have been squandered in this attack. His economic position is not strong. You have a feeling that many of his own generals may have started to grumble behind his back, and possibilities of a coup or assassination might have grown. In other words, the prospect for the Allies is fairly rosy if that happens. And 90% of the time, that's what probably happens. It's just in the world in which we actually inhabit, the 10% of happened. The Black Swan event happened. And so France, to everyone's amazement, is defeated.
One of the factors that you describe in that may have made the difference was the, for lack of a better word, the unwillingness of the leaders of the RAF to send over their full fleet of fighters and every available plane to support the ground war that was taking place in France. As you explained, though, this is because the and I love the way you just kind of bluntly put it, that the RAF always expected to fight a Battle of Britain, and that with the fall of France, that's exactly what they get. They now have this battle, which is of course now part of the mythology of British and you know, let's be a bit more blunt, English identity, but how it's one that as is so often the case when you're talking about mythology, is that there's a lot of misconceptions that accrue around it as well.
So as I say in the book, you know, it's great that the British won the Battle of Britain, but it would have been better still if they hadn't had to fight it in the first place. There had always been a very semi-detached attitude by the British towards the alliance with France. At the beginning of the war, Chamberlain himself had been highly reluctant to make any commitment of fighting a large ground war on continental Europe. He remembered, like many people did, of course, the enormous dreadful battles that had taken place in World War I, the Somme and Passchendaele and so forth. And he wanted, above all, to try and avoid that kind of situation of sending a large British land army to the continent. And so his argument had been to the French that, you know, if there is going to be an alliance, we ought to have a division of responsibility that reflects our particular national strengths. So the French provide the big army that's to fight the German army on the ground. Meanwhile, the British will command the waves, command the seas, and prevent, you know, Germany from being supplied from abroad, will enforce an economic blockade against Germany. And the Royal Air Force will conduct strategic bombing against Germany. The RAF had been created specifically for the purpose of strategic bombing in 1918, and it still regarded its role as an offensive force as being its principal task. Now, the French didn't really see it this way. They thought, well, it's all very well for you to sort of say that you're going to conduct the air war and the sea war, but most of the fighting and the dying is going to take place on the ground. And in a democratic world, you can't really expect one partner to do all of the sacrifice and all of the dying and the other one to sit back. So the British had eventually been forced to see the logic of this position and had sent a ground force to France to fight alongside the French. But it was a fairly small one. And moreover, the Royal Air Force in particular still resolutely refused to commit its, you know, the bulk of its strength, either its fighter force or its bomber force, into defending the ground forces. Now, there's two ways of looking at this. You know, one is that by jealously guarding its resources, it meant that when France fell in June of 1940, the British were in a pretty good position to be able to defend themselves against an air attack by the Germans. They already had a very sophisticated air defense system partly through radar, you know, this new technology, and also a very sophisticated kind of network of command and control. They had, large numbers of fighter aircraft, which they had held behind in reserve during the battle for France. So if you assume that the France was inevitably going to fall, then there does seem to be a great deal of wisdom in the British approach. On the other hand, if you assume, as I do, that actually it wasn't at all inevitable that France was going to fall, that wiser policies and a more full-blooded attitude towards the ground war might have altered the balance, then that British decision seems not just unwise, but also extremely selfish. The French always looked at the alliance as being an alliance of partners, that, you know, if one goes down, both go down. The British never quite had that same kind of commitment. They looked back afterwards when France did fall, of course, they were not, you know, particularly keen to associate themselves very much with this defeat. And they very much looked at it as being France's own fault, that France had been uniquely to blame for its own misery. But it's arguable that, you know, the British themselves were, you know, partly the authors of this defeat, because they had never really taken as seriously the military alliance as they perhaps ought to have done.
But nonetheless, that choice does lead to the battle of, or contributes to the fact that you have this Battle of Britain and this period of sustained warfare where Britain is now under direct attack. The title of one of the chapters there is the scouring of the Shire folk, and it's which of course, as with the Battle of Britain, becomes part of the mythology of British identity. You describe it though again in ways that push back against a lot of what we've, you know, understood about it. For example, with the, you know, image of the war of the Battle of Britain is one of Spitfires and Hurricanes, you know, rising to the challenge, and how they were the war-winning weapons, and they definitely were key to victory. But as you explained, that was what they were expecting. They actually had this different fighter design that was going to be the winner, and it turned out to be a disaster. Or how the, you know, the British remember the Germans constantly bombing them, and that certainly did happen, but it was almost done in a half-hearted way, as the Germans seemed to be losing interest, and how this, you know, caused us to reconsider, you know, in a way, just how serious the threat was, just how prepared the British were, and just how you know, likely it was that the war could have potentially ended in 1940, as the British, you know, like to believe it might have had they been defeated.
Well, the British remember the Battle of Britain. I mean, you know, it is this, of course, this mythical moment as being a moment in which they might so easily have been defeated. That, you know, had events turned slightly against them, then the Germans would have been able to gain air superiority over southeastern England and allow the conditions for an invasion. Historians have pushed back against this a lot in recent years, and I am of the personal belief that there actually was very little chance that once the Battle of Britain had started, that the Germans were going to be able to win, at least in the short term. It's interesting that this is where the reality of the war pushes against the myth. So it very much suits the British self-conception to think of themselves as being a group of rather beleaguered, gentle amateurs who are faced against this overwhelming professional force of, you know, fearsome warriors in 1940. In many ways, it's the opposite way around. The Royal Air Force wins the Battle of Britain because of its strength and its professionalism. The British had been preparing for such a war for a long time. The Germans had not, by contrast, been preparing for a strategic air offensive ever. They had to pretty much invent the whole thing on the fly. And it's a very ad hoc affair. They never really have a great deal of strength to begin with. They'd already taken very significant losses in the Battle of France. They don't have a particularly coherent plan. And I don't think really the outcome is ever actually in doubt. Now, I do think that a couple of months earlier at Dunkirk, there really was a possibility that Britain could have lost the war. Had the British been unable to evacuate their army from Dunkirk at the end of May 1940, and there are lots of reasons why that might have happened, I really do think at that point that some kind of political settlement to the war probably would have been inevitable. But since that thankfully didn't happen, they were in the short term in a very strong position in 1940. The Germans begin the bombing of London, the beginning of the Blitz in early September 1940, not so much as a sign that the British are in a weak position, but because of a lack of being able to think of whatever else to do. They are still sort of seeking some kind of military strategy that might persuade the British to come to the negotiating table. The thing about the Blitz is that it is it's another heroic, mythical moment. It does involve large loss of life. About 40,000 Londoners and other people in Britain, civilians in Britain, are killed during the bombing. But it has actually comparatively little effect on Britain's ability to be able to conduct the war. The Germans don't have any coherent kind of strategic bombing plan for how they're going to sort of knock Britain out of the war. They don't really have any kind of theory about, you know, what kind of factories should you attack, or port installations, or resource supplies, and so on. And so they're very much sort of making this up as they go along. Now, when the Allies, when the British and later the Americans attempt strategic bombing against Germany, particularly after 1942, they do so in much greater strength, and they do so with much more coherent sense about what they're trying to accomplish. And even then, it's a tremendously hard-fought battle. Involves the use of resources, which is far greater than anything that the Germans have in 1940. And even then, it's still controversial about how much difference it really made to Germany's defeat. Strategic bombing just turned out to be a lot more difficult than anybody had realized back in 1939. And you know, by May 1941, when the Germans largely give up strategic bombing and turn instead to the invasion of Russia, you know, it's pretty much a reflection that they have failed, that they have not been able to come up with anything that seems like it's going to crack the British will to continue resisting, or going to have any kind of tangible effect on the British ability to continue to fight. The British are running into some severe financial difficulties by the beginning of 1941, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the Blitz. It has to do with their relationship with the United States.
That relationship becomes a very important part of your book at this point, because you talk about the challenges they face. And again, this is a yet another example where we have this mythology of, you know, the United States and Great Britain standing shoulder to shoulder. The United States may not be in the war, but they're resolutely supporting the British. And again, you point out that wasn't the case. There was contingent upon certain things, such as Roosevelt's victory in the 1940 presidential election, such as Britain's rather perilous finances, and how this, and of course, the ability to access this through through trade, through the shipping, and which of course is being also challenged by the Germans in the war. Though the British themselves are no longer being bombed directly after May 1941, the war is still very much on. And while the advantages may lay with the British, you make it clear that it's not necessarily guaranteed that they're going to win at this point.
So the short-term advantages are certainly with the British in the mid to late point of 1940. The long-term situation, however, is much less clear-cut. When the chiefs of staff, the British military chiefs of staff, give their assessments to Churchill in 1940 about, can Britain actually win this war? You know, they make it very clear that, yes, they think it can, but that victory will be entirely contingent upon the active cooperation of the United States. Britain will require the importation of very large amounts of raw materials and munitions and so on from North America, particularly from the USA. And it will only be able to do so as long as it has the financial wherewithal to be able to pay for them. One of the consequences of American isolationism in the 1930s had been the passage of the Neutrality Acts by Congress, which had meant that, amongst other things, the United States would not sell war materials to any belligerent nation on any terms other than hard currency. So in other words, you had to pay for these things either with dollars or with gold. Britain has, although it has a very large amount of both dollars and gold in 1939, it runs through its surplus pretty dramatically by the mid to late point of 1940. By late 1940, it's becoming increasingly obvious that Britain is going to run out of both dollars and gold fairly soon. And then the question emerges, well, what then? Will the United States continue to cooperate in providing Britain with access to the materials that it needs to continue fighting? And it's not at all clear, certainly in the, you know, the midpoint of 1940, that that is the way that America is going to go. After the fall of France, the threat to the United States from Nazi Germany becomes much more obvious. But what's not obvious is what American policy should be with regard to Britain. Should the Americans regard the British as being their first line of defense? And should they basically therefore provide them with as much assistance as absolutely necessary? Or should they regard the British essentially as being a dead loss? Should they look rather to their own defenses? Should they regard, you know, should they focus on a Western hemispheric defense? And that's a position which is taken up by very influential people around President Roosevelt. So George Marshall, for instance, the chief of staff of the army, believes that in the summer of 1940, that the United States should stop supplying Britain with war materials, that it should concentrate on its own defenses, on the buildup of its own army, and that it should essentially write the British off. And Roosevelt himself, I think, doesn't make an immediate decision about this until quite late. Victory in the Battle of Britain, of course, ultimately sort of turns the Roosevelt administration more towards the idea that, well, yeah, Britain probably is going to be able to survive this, at least for the short term. And so it's worth backing the British. It's worth thinking more seriously about the British as being an ally. And this is the seed of what becomes the Lend-Lease Agreement in March of 1941. So Lend-Lease essentially eliminates this problem about gold and dollars by saying that for the duration of hostilities, the United States will continue to supply Britain with materials, war materials and raw materials and so on, without actually having to pay for them immediately. The bill can be settled at the end of the war. This is an enormous relief for Britain in terms of its ability to continue fighting. It also sets up a lot of problems for the post-war, it has to be said, something I'm going to explore more in the second volume, because it basically turns Britain into a patron, economic patron of the United States. And, you know, the British ability to continue the war is very much going to be contingent upon American acquiescence. And so the power relationship between these two military superpowers is going to change rather markedly as a result of the Second World War. But as I say, that's in 1941, that's sort of a problem for the future. Right now, the crucial moment is that the crucial point is that the Americans will cooperate. Now, having said that, of course, that doesn't mean that just because the United States is economically cooperating with Britain, that it's inevitable that it will enter the war. And for much of 1941, Churchill remains very, very frustrated by the unwillingness of the Roosevelt administration to actually take that final step and enter the war actively. Roosevelt sort of teases Churchill from time to time with this idea that, maybe this will be the moment when he will declare war. He will ask Congress to declare war against Germany. And yet he always backs away at the last moment. When Churchill and Roosevelt meet in Newfoundland for the Atlantic Charter Conference in August of 1941, Churchill goes to that conference thinking that Roosevelt is going to declare war against Germany, that will be his big announcement during the conference. And he's, of course, tremendously disappointed when it becomes clear that Roosevelt has no intention of doing this. And he leaves Newfoundland actually rather depressed and frustrated, and sort of vents in private memorandums and so forth about, you know, how the Americans don't seem to be taking this seriously enough. The United States will enter the war, of course, but it's going to be under very different circumstances in December 1941, thanks to Pearl Harbor.
So dare I ask how Volume 2 is coming along?
Well, COVID isn't making it any easier. and the closure or the only partial opening of archives in the UK, plus the difficulties of international travel and so on, are like every other researcher out there, you know, I am struggling with all of this. I do have some, I think, interesting ideas. I hope they are interesting ideas about how to talk about the second half of the war. And I'll be exploring, you know, both how the Allies actually managed to achieve victory and then also, you know, what kind of country Britain is by 1945, how the war has changed it and how the war has also not changed it as well. And some of the legacies of the war stretching into the second half of the 20th century right up to today, both the economic legacies, political legacies, and also some of the legacies with regards to culture and memory and so on. So I'm hoping, he says very cautiously, for a completion date perhaps in 2024, 2025. But, you know, we're fighting a long war here, you know, and so I don't want to make any premature, you know, declarations of victory. We'll see how things go in the long run.
Well, I hope that when it's finished, we can have you back on the podcast to talk about Volume 2.
Oh, I'd love to. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Alan Allport, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too, Mark.